Let's begin then. So before we begin, let us all take a moment to pay homage to the Supremely Enlightened One, the Perfect One, the Magnificent One, the greatest man that has ever roamed the surface of the earth, He who is our Father, our Teacher, our Guide, and our Master, He who has so clearly laid down the path for all of us to attain our salvation. As we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is a pledge that we take upon ourselves and an oath to be faithful, to be diligent in our practice to the Noble Triple Gem until the end of all suffering for all of us and all sentient beings. Let us now take a moment to do so. Take refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. Observe the precepts before we begin today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
It's time to take the next step. Because I believe you're going from non-believers to believers. You're stepping beyond that point where, although what you believed back in the day was what all you could see through your eyes and could hear through your ears, now you're beginning to realize that there are other things beyond the realm of what is visual. If last week's video did anything for you, it would have given you a glimpse of what fate awaits you. So, it is not just you who need the Dhamma. What about your parents? I don't mean those who are at home today or those who you have brought along with you today. What about your parents who are now gone? Where are they? Some of you may believe that they're in the heavens now. And you probably believe it very strongly. But then, every year, you do an almsgiving and you transfer merits to them. Why should those who have little give to those who have more? You've got to wonder. If someone knocked on your door and you opened the door and in front of you stood a millionaire or a billionaire and you just started to make out in life, you're probably not going to give them anything. Instead, you'd probably ask them for something to help you out. So if you are so sure that your parents are up there, why do you still feel the need to give an alms every year at the end of the 7 days upon their passing away or the 3 month anniversary and so on? It might be that they are there, but we are always doubtful, as we should be, and here's why. When you know how you've lived your life so far, how can you have any assurance of how someone else might have lived their lives? I refer to all of us. There have been good times in our lives, but mostly there have been those times we are ashamed of. Any human being, most human beings, can't say every, but most human beings do more bad than they do good. Chances are, your parents, your forefathers, they were no different. In fact, you know how much bad they had to do just to bring you up? Just to put you into a good school, how many lies they had to tell? How many stories they had to cook up? You know how many stories you had to. Did you know that every time you had to do that, someone else lost out on an opportunity? Someone else's child? My argument is not to or against that. What I'm saying is, These are the ups and downs that we have to go through in life. Unfortunately, we have to reap what we sow. If you were under any threat by another person or an animal, let's just say you were playing outside in your garden and say your pet dog, this is a family pet, comes barking at you. Your mother, your father is standing by the side watching this. This is unexpected, but it comes running at you. Not to play, but the dog's in a fit of fury and he wants to attack you. What do you think your mother's going to do when she sees that? Let's just say she's just walked out of the kitchen and she has a knife with her and the dog's running at you. You're just a kid. You're playing outside. Any mother in the room, put the Dharma to a side and answer this question for me. You see your dog, your pet dog. You've had the dog for the last 3 years, but you've had your child for 5. He's playing outside, the dog comes running, and it looks like the dog's mad. He's an angry dog. Now you want to save your child, you have a knife in your hand. What do you think you're going to do? I think the answer is pretty obvious. But the number of times that they had to save you, you remember when the mosquito bit you, what did your mother do? Supatveva to the mosquito. More like Chutaveva, right? In saving a life, she earned merits. In taking away one, she earned demerits. One doesn't cancel out the other. Unfortunately, that's not how things work. So to think that all our past ones, our loved ones, as they pass away, they all ascend into the heavens, I think it's a nice story we like to tell ourselves. It's a fantasy. At every junction, you see the Kattariyas. They do all these rituals to try and chase away evil spirits. In every other home you go to, these people have problems with the dead ones because they just don't stay dead, do they? They keep coming back. You've got to be worried if your mother is so attached to your children, because if she's terribly attached to her grandchildren, chances are she's not going to go away for some time. Even when she says goodbye, that's not a goodbye. Attachment is such a disease of the heart, ladies and gentlemen. You've got to understand that. So be it that they're in the heavens or be it that they're in the Preta worlds, they're all sentient beings, and the only reason that they're still there doing their rounds in samsara is because they have yet to come across the Buddha's teaching. There is no other path that helps one to free oneself entirely and comprehensively and fully from attachment and free oneself from samsara. Therefore, this is why whenever we do a sermon, we invite them. Now, here's the thing. Even though we make an invitation, not everyone is capable of coming here. Unfortunately. For that also, they need merits. That's why it takes merits to do merits. There's a saying like that, and it is true. It takes merits to do merits. You have the merits to be here today, so therefore, well, now that you're here, you do even more merits. That's the way it works. Seems a bit unfair, doesn't it? But that's the way it is. Unfortunately, it's always a catch-22. No matter where you look, it's always a catch-22. That's why for those who don't have merits, it takes a terribly long time, ladies and gentlemen, to get themselves out of samsara. I mean, leave aside getting themselves out of samsara, just to even walk into a temple, offer something to someone who is virtuous than them. Not necessarily a bhikkhu, not necessarily a Buddhist monk. Someone who is more virtuous. Just the other day I was reading, someone told me, recently some person got arrested by the police for raping his own mother? Welcome to the land of the Buddha. You may be disgusted by that. I feel sympathy. This is what a human mind can do when it has no refuge in the Dhamma. If we had asked that mother, that very mother, if we had asked that mother a few years ago, say a few months ago, a few weeks ago, no, let's just say the previous day, mother, do you think your child would ever do something like that to you? Before the event. What do you think the mother would have said? Never. She'd probably have gone mad at me for asking the question. Yeah? How can you even think of asking me a question like that? To ask a mother whether the child would one day rape her? How could you even ask something like that? But now if you ask her, she'd say, I never expected that, but mothers, hello. I'm speaking to you now. Do you think your child would ever do something like that to you? No, right? Yeah. No. Said that mother a day before the incident. Says every mother before it happens. Says every father. Do you think your son would ever stab you? Because he's asked you for something. He's asked you for money. He's asked you for the next for a PlayStation. He's asked you for some money to buy a bottle of alcohol. He's asked you to give permission to go to a party. You think your son would ever hit you, attack you, strike you, stab you? Never. Always before the fact. Never. But after the fact? Better be safe than sorry, don't you think? This is why I always keep going on about this. It is not enough just to give our children education. They're educated enough, yes. Education is not what's going to save them. As long as attachment prevails in the mind, ladies and gentlemen, there's always going to be vexation. And as long as the mind vexes, the mind is always looking for a way to relieve itself from vexation. It's like the pressure cooker at home. You've used it so many times, haven't you understand the concept? Once the pressure starts building in there, what happens next? Unless there's a way for that pressure to be relieved, what's going to happen? Well, fortunately, at home, you have a nozzle in the pressure cooker that allows the pressure to be released. You've either got to release the pressure or switch off the cooker. If you don't do one of these two things, then you'll be sorry. The cooker, the pressure cooker is going to blow up. What makes you think it's a different concept when it comes to the mind? That's physical pressure. This is mental pressure, psychological pressure. Once the pressure starts building, you know, I was thinking to myself the other day, it's quite likely, and don't take me wrong for saying this, I don't mean this in any way rude or in an impolite way. A lot of people, the reason that they don't resort to killing, lying, backstabbing, slander, the 10 unmeritorious deeds, stealing and so on, is because they simply have the means to relieve themselves from vexation. That's why. Unless you understand the Dhamma, the reason that you don't steal is because when you want something, there's a way to go and get it. You have the means to go and get it. That's why you don't steal. You'll tell me, no, Swami Nuhansa, it's not so. I will not steal no matter what. It's easier said than done. Because once the pressure starts building inside, do you think the pressure cooker can make a resolve? I'm not going to blow up if you don't let the steam out? You think a mere determination can do that? No. Either that, or you should have practiced your resolve, your determination over a long time in samsara. Then it becomes a paramita. Kanti is a paramita. Kanti is patience. It's a paramita. If you've practiced that for yawns and yawns and yawns, at least years and years and years, then it becomes possible. Aren't your lives a testimony to the fact that If you can't get something legally, lawfully, rightfully, you will find other ways to get it. Let me be quiet for a minute. Why don't you go back, take a trip down memory lane and ask yourself this question, had I not done that? I'll give you a minute on the clock. Although today you might claim to be very virtuous. Right now we're all feeling very virtuous, aren't we? We've just observed the precepts. Don't we all feel we're very good people? We always do. We do. Until the moment comes when it's by hook or by crook and the mind starts to vex. It is exactly like the pressure cooker. Once the pressure starts building inside, folks, there is either you have to switch off the cooker, which is what I'm trying to help you do, switch off the cooker, or you've got to let the steam out. There is something in this world on whose behalf you will do whatever it takes to keep it safe. It might be your children. If someone comes running up to your child with a dagger in his hand, are you as a father just going to turn a blind eye? Of course not, because you're going to tell me, Swaminas, what do you expect? I'm a father. A father must protect their children like a ferocious lion. That's what a father is supposed to do. Okay. In saving your child, you'll earn a merit. But in killing another life, taking another life, you earn demerits. Ultimately, you're the one who has to pay. It matters not why you've done the demerit. That's the thing. They don't ask you. They don't ask for your rationale. They don't ask you to rationalize it. Have you, haven't you, is all they ask, not why. So if anything, if you took anything away from last week's video, that's why I said this is the fate that awaits you. I, myself included, all of us, we are all guilty. We are all guilty. That's why Jesus once said that he who has not sinned cast the first stone. How many stones were cast? How many stones were cast? None. They all walked away with their heads hung low, because they realized none of us are innocent. We are all guilty. We are all guilty of killing. Are we not? I haven't killed anyone. I'm not talking about anyone. I'm talking about the countless number of mosquitoes you've killed. Is that not a life? A life is a life is a life. That's a life. The number of flies we've killed, the number of rodents we've killed, the number of pests that we've killed. How many? Anyone care to give me a count? Each of those is killing. Pranagatha is pranagatha. But perhaps the previous day, the very previous day, you observed the five precepts. The previous day was poya. At the temple, you observed the precepts, you went back home, and you sat down for dinner, and the familiar. How long do you spend listening to the chorus? I've seen young children who make it a game. They make a game out of it. You've seen fly squatters, right? They look something like this. I've seen siblings at home. It's a match between the two, Ayya and Malli. How many today? So they walk around the house squatting flies. So every half an hour or so they take a score. What are you? How many? 10? 15? Score. I've seen children who do that. What they don't realize is a life is a life is a life. This is all pranagata. It doesn't have to be a human being. Perhaps the demerit that you earn out of it is not as bad as if you would kill a human being. Yes, that is true, but a demerit is a demerit. So you'll ask me, Swami, so what are we supposed to do then? Are we supposed to let the rats come and infest the house? Is that what you're asking us to do? Are you asking us to let the house flies take over the house and we stay out? If there's an ant infestation, I have a bookshelf that has all these valuable books. Right? They're very hard to come by. And then the other day there were termites. Bookworms. What are you supposed to do? You'll ask me. My answer is, Nibbana is the only bliss. The Buddha really doesn't come into this world to teach us how to live a righteous life, honestly. Although it seems like it. It seems like the Buddha comes into this world to teach us how to live a righteous life, right? You don't need the Buddha for that. Jesus Christ did that perfectly well. He did. Study the Bible. Take your time, study the Bible, and you can live a very righteous life. Abstaining from unmeritorious deeds, doing lots of good deeds, and you can earn plenty of merits. And sure as hell, you'll end up in heaven. Actually, sure as hell, you'll end up in heaven doesn't sound right. The Buddha doesn't come into this world to teach you how to live a righteous life. That's not his intention. That's a bonus. It's just a bonus. His purpose is to help us get out of samsara altogether. Because here's the deal. If you want to live as a human being, ladies and gentlemen, there I don't see a way in which you can only do good deeds and not do any bad deed. If there's anyone in the room who can put their hand up and say, no, Swami Nuhansa, there is a way I can do just good deeds and not a single bad deed. I'd like to hear from them. It's impossible. When you're ill, you've got to take medicines, right? Say you have a bacterial infection. Let's put bacteria to a side. Let's say you've got a worm infection. Then you take a vermicide. When you take it, don't you know you're killing? So what do you do then? Don't take your vermicide? Is that what you do? That's the thing. There are no right or wrong answers. In this game, there are no right or wrong answers. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Welcome to samsara. That's the motto of samsara. When you walk through the gates of samsara, you'll see the motto. What does it say? You are damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Either way, you're damned. That's why the Buddha's purpose is to help us get out of this eternal damnation. People, when they talk about eternal damnation, they refer to the four great hells. I think samsara is a greater hell than that. You know, we just live on the verge of hell. Is there anyone here who's lived a holy life? Anyone? Any saints in the room? Not a single demeritorious deed conducted in their entire lives? Have you never been angry? And shouted at someone out of anger. Anger itself is an unmeritorious deed. It doesn't require you actually speaking it out. You don't have to shout at someone. Just anger itself is a mental demerit. There are three such demerits. Greed is one of them. It's called abhidya. Do you realize how easy it is to do one of those things? Especially those in relationships. You think what's so bad about a relationship, right? Some of these things you really don't want me to say. Honestly. Some things are maybe best left unsaid. Because life can get difficult after that. Once you begin to realize the hole that you keep digging for yourself, and every day you spend, you just keep digging it deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And it seems like there's no way out of it. When you're in a relationship, well, I'm going to say it anyway. You can close your ears if you don't like to hear this. When you're in a relationship, let's say a boy is in a relationship with a girl. Ladies in the house, you can apply it to yourselves the other way around. When a boy is in a relationship with a girl, it starts off just being friends. We're just friends. Just friends. Then it's a special friendship. Then it's like best friends. And then it gets to a relationship, an affair. At some point, it comes a point where there are certain kind of smiles that should be reserved for the partner. Yeah? Certain smiles only for me. Why did you smile at him like that? What was that for? I mean, you never smile like that to anyone else. You only smile like that with me. Why did you smile like that with him? What was that for? Have you not heard these questions? You've either asked these questions or someone has asked these questions of you. Why did you wave at him like that? You know, you're just supposed to wave like this. Why did you go like this? What was that all about? You know, when you shook hands, why did you hold on for like an extra second? Was that necessary? These questions, they start coming up. Why so many messages? You could have just said, bye. Why the XOXO? Was that necessary? You know what avidya is? Here's what avidya is. It's an unmeritorious deed that is done in the mind. And the long and the short of it is, when you see good, something good happening to someone else, in your mind you have envy, out of jealousy, out of greed. You wish for that goodness not to happen to that person, but to happen only and exclusively to yourself. That is avidya. Now tell me, when you are in a relationship, how can you say that you are completely innocent of that? Because when you are in a relationship with someone, when you really love someone, love is an emotion, when you are really strongly attached to someone, now, usually this is, you know, this is in a relationship year, you know, this is normally until the honeymoon period passes. You know, after you become husband, wife, spend a good few years together, now you don't care who she smiles with, right? But until such time, at the very least, there are certain smiles that have to be just for you. There are certain words that have to be just for you. Certain expressions just for you. So much so that if he or she shares such emotions, shares such words or such smiles, such gestures with anybody else, you feel jealousy, you feel greed, you feel envy, and out of that you start saying things to try and change their behaviors because you don't like that. Ladies and gentlemen, let me share with you that is avidya. Because someone else is benefiting from a smile, you don't like it. You don't like it. She's smiling at somebody else and you don't like it. Because that smile should be reserved for whom? For you. So you don't like it. That is avidya. It's one of the 10 unmeritorious deeds. You don't even know you're doing it. So how anyone could be in a relationship and not commit an unmeritorious deed is beyond me. Those days I didn't used to see the world in this way, but now I realize, good gosh, it would be a wonder actually if people actually attain Nibbana. It would be a wonder. Nibbana is a very different beast altogether, ladies and gentlemen. Because Nibbana is out of this world. It transcends all material existence as you know it. It's incredibly difficult. You know, if you ask me, how can I be in a good relationship? How can I have a loving family relationship and still get to Nibbana? Good luck. It's unfair for me to say these things. I know, I understand. It seems unreasonable. Because I'm speaking to an audience of individuals who have to live their lay lives. You are bound to your duties and responsibilities. You are now attached to the people that you are attached to. And yet I have to somehow show you a path out of this entanglement to Nibbana. I'll tell you, it's not going to be easy. It's possible, it's not going to be easy though. If it were, why did the Buddha establish the Sanghasasana? Did he just ask for trouble? What did he want? I mean, he'd already attained Buddhahood, right? He didn't need the Sangha. So why did he establish the Sangha community? Why did he establish the community of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis? Because you need the environment which supports you to get to that destination where you've never been before. A worldly existence is one. But to get out of this world, to get out of samsara, is an entirely different thing, ladies and gentlemen. But I'm not expecting you to do that tomorrow. It doesn't need to happen by tomorrow. But it needs to happen to you someday at some point. Have that in the back of your heads, at the back of your minds, somewhere in your heart, have that as a resolve. One day I'm going to do whatever it takes to step out of samsara, and if it's ordination I have to do, if it is to go into the sasana I have to do one day, I'll work towards that. I'm not asking you to do that tomorrow. Because that would be unfair. I wish that upon every man, woman and child in this room, for you to be able to step into the sasana. Because that is the gateway to Nibbana. It certainly is. It is the exit door to samsara. There have been very few individuals, very few indeed, maybe a handful of individuals, if you go through the Buddhist history, scriptures, a handful of individuals who attained arahathood while remaining in a lay life. Not even the great elder Sariputta Thera was able to attain arahathood by remaining as a lay person. Once again, I admit this is probably not the right audience to be giving this discourse to. But all I'm saying is, have that resolve in the back of your minds one day, just one day. When that one day might be is up to you to decide. Whether that is next week, next month, next year, in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, next lifetime. Just have that as a resolve in the back of your minds. Am I asking you to do something impossible? Am I? Not tomorrow. In 10 lifetimes time. In 100 lifetimes. And the only reason I'm saying this, ladies and gentlemen, is because today, when I was a lay person, I honestly thought that living a lay life and attaining Nibbana, entirely possible. It's still possible. But today I realize how incredibly difficult that is. You can become a sotapanna. Because to become a sotapanna, all you got to do is to have the merits to become one, and then to listen to a discourse, and understand the Dhamma. But then from there on, something much more important needs to happen, and that is your practice. Remember, you're trying to untrain your mind. That's what you got to do. Your mind is trained to resort to relief from vexation whenever it's vexed. It's habitual for us. When you want something to eat, what do you do? Do you sit down and reflect upon that, or do you walk up to the fridge and open it and eat it? What do you normally do? And you know it's there in the fridge. You know it's in the kitchen. You know it's in the cupboard. When you drive past a driveway, a restaurant, a takeaway, you drive past a chicken shop, a pizza place, Chinese, whatever, right? And you feel, you inhale the aroma, and now you want to have it. What do you normally do? Do you pull up, and you go into meditation pose, and you contemplate? Etang santang, etang panitang. Or do you go rupang anicca, vedana anicca, sanya anicca? What do you normally do? You do what has become habitual for you. We are creatures of habit. We are. Because once something becomes a habit, you don't need to think about it. It is our automatic response to things. It is the path of least resistance. We always take that. Don't we? We always take the path of least resistance. Habits are our path of least resistance. That's why when you know that you've got some chocolate in the fridge, you know that you've got some ice cream in the fridge, and you walk past it, it feels like there's some kind of spirit working on you. And you can't help yourself. You walk up to it, open the fridge, take the tub, sit down, and you started eating. You don't even know it's happening. How many times have you thought to yourself, no, I'm going to stop with the next bite. And then what happens? You don't realize until the whole tub has been eaten. You know this is true, ladies and gentlemen, because I know it is true, because I've been there and I've done that. Like I said, I didn't fall from the skies like this. I walked the path that you have. I know what this feels like. That's why I say it's incredibly difficult. But once you're in the Sangha community, you're constantly surrounded by noble association. At the monastery, if this young Swami Nuhansa, he wants ice cream, there is no fridge he can walk up to open it and take it and start eating. Some listening to this will go, ayo, pauappa. Sinno? Such a young boy. But that's not the solution to the problem. If eating ice cream is the answer to wanting ice cream, by this point, you should have cured that illness. How many times over? Don't you still want ice cream? It's not the body that wants ice cream. It's the mind that asks for it. But here's the funny thing. The mind wants ice cream. How many spoonfuls of ice cream have you actually fed the mind so far? Tell me. Is it the tongue that wants ice cream? The tongue? No. Your mouth? Your body? No. It's your mind that wants ice cream. Which part of the digestive system is the mind attached to? None. So every time you eat ice cream, how is the mind fed? It's the mind who asks for it, but the mind doesn't get it. Therefore, the mind can never be satisfied. But it seems like the mind is happy. It's because the mind thinks that the body is also mine. This is all because of Sakkaya Ditti. What I promise you to talk about today. All down to Sakkaya Ditti. Because you can't help thinking that your body is also yours. And you can't help thinking that your mind is also yours. So when I ask you, who are you? You have an answer. So I'm an answer. I am my body and my mind. Because you feel that your body belongs to you and your mind belongs to you. So when you take the body and the mind apart, there's still a you to whom the body and the mind belongs. That's how you feel. That's why you ask the question, what will this do to my body? Then you ask the question, what will this do to my mind? So when you say, what will this do to my mind, where's the you who's talking about the mind? What will this do to my mind, you ask me. Say, for example, we go on a meditation program somewhere. Okay? And they tell you, let's just take hypnosis. So we're going to get you all a hypnotherapist and they're going to do hypnosis. One of the questions you will have is, before you sit down for the procedure, what will this do to my mind? So now you have a question. What will this do to my mind? Who's asking this question? I am asking this question. So I'm now speaking on your behalf. Yeah? You are asking this question. You are asking the question as to what hypnosis is going to do to what? Your mind. So if your mind is what hypnosis is going to do something to, that's not you then, is it? Because you don't say, what is it going to do to me? What's it going to do to my mind? So if it's my mind it's going to do something to, then that's not you. Then we ask you to eat something, maybe take some pills. Then you're going to ask another question. What's it going to do to my body? So where's the you then? So there's my mind and there's my body. Let me draw it out for you. Mind. Body and mind. Me. Who is this? Do you understand the question? Who is that who refers to this as their mind? I've only drawn a star because the mind, I don't know how to draw the mind. It doesn't have a shape, right? It's just to represent the mind. Who is this? Let's put it in the box. I want you to give me an answer. Who is this who says that this is my mind and this is my body? Who's that then? I, right? I. Me. This is what you call self. You've heard of Sakkāya-ditthiya self-view. Haven't you? Sakkāya-ditthiya, if you've done any Buddhist study, it refers to a self-view. So who does the body belong to? Me. Who does your mind belong to? See, even in the question itself, who does your mind belong to? Who? Me. You don't say, Swaminanda, I am the mind. You don't say that. You say, my mind belongs to me. I don't want to lose my mind. What will this do to my mind? I can't, what my mind? Control my mind. Don't you say these things? See, if you are the mind, then how come you can't control your mind? A car never says, I can't control myself. The driver says that. I can't control the car. But the car never says that because the car is the car. But the driver can't control the car, so the driver says, I lost control of the car. Yeah? Don't you? Aren't there times where you don't want to do something, but still you're urged to do it? You feel the urge to do it, and then you go and do it anyway? Aren't there times like that? Take the ice cream again. The doctor said, stop eating ice cream. Woman, you are fat. Stop eating ice cream. Your sugar is at 200. You're going to die if you continue at this rate. Stop eating ice cream, the doctor says. And then you walk past the freezer. Temptations. So much so they name it temptations, don't they? So then you say, oh, I'm so sorry, doctor. I've not been good last month. I promised you I would control my diet, but I couldn't because the temptations were just so strong. I couldn't control my feelings. Don't you say that? So who is it that can't control their feelings? Are the feelings in the body? No, the feelings are all mental. So when you say, I couldn't control my feelings, who is it that couldn't control their feelings? Because the feelings are in the mind, right? You agree with me on that? You're talking about a mental aspect. So who was it that couldn't control the feelings? Who was that? I. Where is that I? In which cell of your body does that I live? Is it in your head? Is it in your heart? In your brain, maybe? Is it part of your consciousness? Is it some other kind of spirit? People those days refer to it as the Atma. My spirit, my Atma. And people ask the question, you know, when I die, where will my Atma go? Because you know it's going to leave the body behind. And those who believed in previous lives, who still believe, they know that the things that they wanted in their previous lives, they may not want now. Especially, what about your memories from your previous lives? Why don't you have them now? If it was you who had those memories, why don't you have them now? Did you choose to leave them behind? I'm asking you some pertinent questions, ladies and gentlemen. Start thinking along these lines, please. Did you choose to forget everything you did in your last life when you came into this one? Did you? You didn't. So why can't you remember anything? If it was you who experienced all that. If it was you who did all those things, why can't, if you remained, you left the body behind, you remained, you left the mind behind, but you remained, so why can't you remember any of that? Where is that you? Where is this self that you experience? You know it's there, don't you? You can feel it. When you feel hurt, Someone hurts your feelings, what do you say? I feel hurt. Or you say, my mind is hurt. I feel hurt. So where is that I who feels hurt? Say last night your child said something to you, right? Or your spouse said something to you, your best friend said something to you, called you names, and you were hurt. Right now, you're not hurt. So where is he who got hurt? What happened to that person? Did you leave him at home? Why didn't you bring them here so that I could talk to them? Where are they? Where is your soul? Where is your spirit? Where is your Atma? Where is yourself? Where is it? But you always talk about it. When you say, I am good, who are you referring to? You're referring to yourself. I'm good. I'm bad. I'm not feeling too good today. I'm happy. Who are you referring to? So if you are the one who is happy, why can't you control that? Why aren't you always happy? Why aren't you always happy? Why don't you control yourself when you're happy and not let yourself go into a bad mood? Why don't you do that? Why don't you? You don't have answers to these questions. No wonder, that's why you're here. Here's the deal. There is no such self. Although you perceive that you are an individual, you are a self, you are an identity, this is merely the product of a view. A view is what we call a drushti. It's a flaw in your thought process. It's a flaw in your thinking process. It's the realization of an ignorant idea in your mind. You create this perception of a self. The self doesn't really exist. You create that perception within your own minds. That's why you can't control yourself. Anyone here who's never felt this feeling, put your hand up. Where you've had, there were things you knew you shouldn't be doing. There were things you knew was wrong, but you couldn't help yourself from feeling that way. You felt the temptations, you felt the urges, and sometimes you just couldn't hold yourself back and you went and did them anyway. Today, sometimes you regret them. You repent them. Those are some of the ugly things of the past. You try to forget them. But even when you try to forget things, don't they still come back to you? So who is that person it keeps coming back to? Don't you all have a secret that you want to try and forget? Don't you all have a secret that you want no one to find out about? We all have such secrets. Don't you all have things you would never walk up and talk to in public and share with everyone? Because those are secrets. They are in the dark and dark corners of our minds. We don't want them to be exposed. Who is it that you're trying to protect then by keeping them secrets? This self. Because you want self-dignity, self-respect. Don't you? Why do you feel offended when someone comes and calls you names? If you're a bit like me, someone comes and calls you Tatya. Why do you feel offended? Self-respect. Dignity. Where is that self? Because if we can catch that self, we can fix the problem, don't you think? This self that lives within each and every one of you, who gets hurt, if we can somehow trap this self using whatever spell that we might have in our command, right? In fact, that is what I'm going to give you today, a spell. With this spell, you know, there are spells to catch evil spirits. You can do Om Ring Namo Shivaya, you can cast a spell and then you can catch evil spirits. Right? I'm going to give you a spell that's going to help you catch this self so that you can do whatever you want with it afterwards. Because here's what you do know. This self that you experience is the self that always torments you. It's what makes you suffer today for your wrongdoings of yesterday. Yes or no? You have a past from yesterday that you want to forget and move on. But does it let you do that? No. Who doesn't let you do that? Any part of your body? It might be that the sin was committed using parts of your body. Perhaps the sin was committed. Your body was an accomplice. Perhaps. And you felt so dirty. After having done that, you might have even gone to the shower and taken a wash. With the hope that now I'm clean. But now you've cleaned your body and you know that a chitta only lasts as long as the chitta does. That's the nature of the mind. It arises and passes away. Right? So the moment it passes away, the next chitta that arises is not the previous chitta. So it cannot be something about the mind then. But there's a self in here somewhere where we are still trying to try and isolate and trap that keeps telling you, look at what you did yesterday. Don't you remember what you did yesterday? You son of a... You all suffer because of that. We need to find the spell to catch that evil self. These are the ghosts of our past. And not only the past, also the future. Because you have a future in your mind, ladies and gentlemen, you can never be at peace. Deny this statement if you can. You can never be at peace today because you have a future and you have a past. The truth is, though, there is neither. There is only the present. But in your minds, and actually not in the mind, remember, the mind is only present when the mind is present. Is this making sense to you? Just give me a show of hands if this sounds like gobbledygook. It's not making any sense at all, Swami Nahas. I don't know what the heck you're talking about today. So it's making some sense to everyone, right? Okay. Because I know this is quite a step from some of the things we've been talking about. So I'm trying to take you further into the ocean of samsara. Not samsara, the Dhamma, sorry. Out of samsara, but through the Dhamma. It can get deep. But that's why we learn to swim before we get into the water. So we've been taking swimming lessons over the past few weeks, past few months. But from time to time, I take you a little bit into the deep end and then bring you back quickly. Because I don't know how far I can go with you. Because you still live their lives. If you are a monk, if you are an anagarika or an anagarika, no holds barred. Nothing reserved. I'd give it to you as it is. So forgive me. And I don't do it out of spite. I do it only because there are some treatments that can only be given in the operating theatre. I can't do open heart surgery here because we have to go to the theatre first. This is the OPD. No? OPD is on every Sunday morning. Consultation hours, 8:30 to 10:30. Is this not the outpatients department? So I'm not going to do open heart surgery. I can't. I can't do brain surgery on you. I can't replace the parts that are broken that cannot be recovered. There are some parts that cannot be salvaged. They have to be discarded and a new part fitted. But I can't do that when you're here. For that, you have to walk into the theater with me. Then they dress you up in what you need for the theater, see? This is the gown that they put onto you when you walk into the theater. It's red just in case. You start to bleed. So anyhow, I'll make an effort, okay? Let's try and do keyhole surgery then, rather than do open heart. So where were we? Past and the future. For as long as you live in a past and you live in a future, you cannot live in peace. These two things are mutually exclusive. Living at peace versus living in the past or living in the future. I'll prove this to you. You can't be happy right now because there are things that you like, there are things that you love, and you are worried about what might happen to them. I'll give you a few examples and you can give me a few nods. Let's start with something so dear to you. Your children. Some of them may be at home. Some may be some in another country. Some may be with cousins. Some may be with some other relatives. You know, these days, children are not safe anywhere. More times than not, when I've come across children who were sexually abused, they were abused by a close relative of the family. So if you've left your children today with their uncle or their aunt, can you tell me that you are at peace right now? Yes, you trust them. Yeah, until. That's always how it is. That mother trusted her son until. Look at the stats. Don't take my word for it. Most children are sexually abused by a close relative. There may be some in the audience who've been a victim of that. And if that has ever happened to you, ask yourself, was it not an uncle? Was it not an aunt? Because your parents trusted that you'd be safe in their custody. So they left you with them. It's not because your uncle and your aunt didn't love you. They did. They knew that this was family. And they knew that this was their own blood. They knew that. But here's the thing. Once the pressure starts building, it's the same concept. Like the pressure cooker that you have at home. If you don't release the pressure, you have to switch off the cooker. If you don't do either one of these two things, there comes a point where the cooker blasts. And that's what happened to them. If you have ever been a victim of that, sexual abuse, it would have been from someone who was trusted. Hardly ever do you get someone who was abused by someone they didn't know. Look at the stats. Look at the stats. Deny this if you can. I dare you. Because once the pressure starts building, you're only looking for the shortest path to freedom from there. The least path to resistance. Now you got your nephew with you. He's only 7 years old. He's young. He's tender. She's young. She's fragile. She's naive. All you got to do is say, "Puta, don't tell anyone. Uncle's going to show you something. Don't tell anyone, okay?" And if you do, I know there are victims in the room. There might even be a few perpetrators. I don't have resentment towards any of you, because I know that was what pressure did to you. I know that was what defilements did to you. I know that was what attachment did to you. I know that was what vexation did to you. There may be those in the audience who were unfaithful to their spouses. It's okay. I understand. I don't know about others, but I understand. I understand that in those moments you felt like you had no choice. Don't nod your heads. I don't want to give it away to anybody. It's enough for you and me to know that, that's all. Nobody else needs to know. I know that in those moments you felt like you had no choice. There was a voice at the back of your head going, "Don't do that. She's your wife's sister, for heaven's sake." There was a voice at the back of your head. Her parents trusted you with her. Don't do that, for heaven's sake. There was a voice at the back of your head, but you were a pressure cooker. The heat was on and the pressure was building inside. And it kept on building inside. Maybe you were the teacher and she was a student. Maybe you were the doctor and she was the patient. Maybe you were the boss and he or she was your colleague. Morals out the door at those times, ladies and gentlemen. Patience can only do so much. Patience can only do so much. That's why they say patience is a virtue. Virtues can only do so much. It is the Dhamma that does the rest. So I understand. I understand exactly why you were a victim of that and also why you committed the sin. I understand. In my heart, you have equal place. Both the sinner and who was the victim of the sin. To me, you're both equals. One did it previously. The other got it done this time. What you give is what you get. It all comes down to this. You live in fear because of the future. So therefore, if you have children, how can you be happy right now? Say you sent your children off for education, further studies. You send them off to Canada. And you get to hear that there's some civil unrest going on there. Your boy goes to the best university in the country. But there's been a stabbing, let's say. It's on the news. There's been some gunfire. I mean, in some countries it's becoming commonplace now, isn't it? Every other week there's gunfire at a school, some public venue or some sort. So you've sent your child now for further education and they're at school and you get to hear on news there's been gunfire. Now, once it's happened once, or you know that it has happened to somebody else, you can now no longer be in peace because you have a fear of the future. What might just happen? You're always living in fear. You're always living in fear. Your car's parked outside. You're living in fear. All I got to do is remind you of the object, and all the fear starts flooding. Maybe you got to hear on the grapevine that someone at the workplace, your husband's workplace, has started flirting with him. Today there's a work party. You got to be here, your husband has to go to the work party. But you got to hear that someone at the workplace is flirting with him. Now, hello, listen to me. Impossible. Because you saw that text message come in on the phone. You asked him, what's that? No, it's nothing. Can I see nothing, please? You know, there's only so much you can push, because then you start treading on territory which they feel like you're encroaching, and then they don't get their personal space. Yeah? Now, lovely these words are, their personal space. So then they don't get that. Then they come back and tell you, why don't you trust me? Now they entangle you in that mess. You don't trust me. How can this relationship go on like this if you don't trust me? You know what I'm talking about? How do you know what I'm talking about? So how can you focus on Nibbana, I ask you? With all hell having broken loose in your heads, ladies and gentlemen, how can you focus on Nibbana? Because you're fighting your everyday battles. Every day. You're worried about your children because you live in the future. You're worried about your mortgage. If they announce to you that in your company they are starting to let go of people, job cuts are just around the corner. They say this is after this year, right? 25%, 30% of your company, they're going to let go of them, made redundant. And you were planning on your retirement, and you were planning on the next year, next couple of years, you're going to pay off your mortgage, all that was planned. And then you get this announcement that they're going to make some job cuts. Now, from that point forward, you live in great fear. What if? So for as long as you have this what if working in your mind, you can't be at peace. You know, these are the two things that you worry about. What now, after it has happened? And what if it happens? Isn't it? Fear and grief. When grief strikes, you go, what now? And when fear strikes, what if? Between what if and what now, you have lived your lives. Who suffers? And that's just a couple of examples. Then you get told that, you know, someone in your family, they've got a terminal illness. You've just been informed. They've come back from the doctors and they've been diagnosed with something terminal. Say they've got cancer. And the doctor said they have 3 months to live. But they've said if you try and get themselves the best treatment, we can extend it by another 3 months. But that treatment doesn't come cheap. For that, either you have to send them abroad or you've got to get the medicines from abroad. And that's going to cost you an arm and a leg. And now you're trying to figure how to get the money to give them the treatment. Now you're fearing a death that is to happen in the future. There is no way you can sit down in this sermon and listen to me attentively while that is working in your mind. Because now the pancha nivarana, the five hindrances have taken over. Uddacha is one of them. Kamachanda is a nivarana. Kamachanda is when your mind is full of lust and strongly affected by desire. At that point, you know the Dhamma doesn't do anything for you. It's like, you know, have you never had this situation where, just forget the Dhamma for a second, you're in a class, a tuition class, school class. You're sat down here, there's a pretty girl sat down two rows next to you. Now the teacher's teaching chemistry. While the teacher's teaching chemistry, there's chemistry going on already within you. At the end of that lesson, I'll give you a test. What do you think? You're going to pass or fail? Most will fail that test. Because that's not where their mind is. You can't focus. You know, every day your children have to go through this. So the reason that they fail in their exams is not simply because they don't attend the classes. It's because they can't focus on what's important in class because you're not giving them the Dhamma. Because once Kamachanda take over, strong desire, lust, once the mind becomes susceptible and vulnerable to desire, now the mind cannot focus. When the cricket is on, do you get any work done at home? Gents? When the cricket is on, do you get any work done at home? When the rugby is on, do you get any work done at home? No. Why not? Kamachanda. Karma is not just carnal desires. All of that is karma. There is rupa karma, shabda karma, gandha karma, rasa karma, sparsha karma. All this is karma. When the mind is taken over by lust and by desire, then logic, rhyme, reason, all of these things go away. You can't focus on anything after that. You can't focus on what is right, what is necessary, what is needed in the moment. Vyapada is another nivarana, is another hindrance. Vyapada is when you have great anger, hate, ill will. You seek the destruction of someone else. You seek to destroy them. You seek to take away any goodness from happening to them. You want to see nothing but bad happen to them. Because you're angry with them. It might be because they've done something bad to you, but now you want tit for tat. You want to take revenge. When such thoughts appear in your mind, at that point, logic goes out. At that point, you fail to see all the good things that they have done for you. All of that is lost. How many times in your lives have you come across people who will sometimes avenge you for some small shortcomings, having forgotten all the good things that you have done for you, that you've done for them? All the good that you've done for them. It may be a few years ago, you know, you helped them out when they were in a financial turmoil, but now they've forgotten all that, just because you didn't invite them to a party. But all the times you help them, they've forgotten all that. And you say, how ungrateful they are. They ask you for a favor, and because you're not able to help them at that point, you say, I'm sorry, I can't help you at this point. That's all they remember from there on. All the help that you've given them until then, forgotten. Tell me you've never come across people like that. There are plenty and more people like that out there. That is because once Vyapada Nivarana takes over, you don't see logic. In the same way, when Uddacha happens, meaning you're restless. You're restless because of two main reasons, your past and your future. That is why you're restless. If you know that your son's coming over tonight, you got to go to the airport and collect him, the flight's at 8 p.m. Or let's say you finish the sermon at 10:30, then in the afternoon you got to go and collect your boy, from the airport. He's arriving at 3 o'clock. You're restless now. You can't help it. Because in your mind, you can't wait for that thing to happen. In this chitta, what you have to experience is the sights and the sounds present in this moment. But because you create a self inside you, you cast a net into the future and you start to live in that future. And therefore, you become restless. The mind is now unsettled. Then it doesn't matter what the Swaminarayan is preaching. Maybe the Swaminarayan is giving you the perfect doctrine to help you attain Nibbana. But all of that is now gone because the mind is so restless. When you are shocked, you are restless. Aren't there times where someone says something to you and then you find it terribly difficult to forgive them? And just the shock of it remains with you sometimes throughout the rest of the day? And that's all you can think about? Someone says something to you and you're terribly upset by what they have said. And then from there on till the end of the day, all you can think about is that. Someone else comes and asks you, are you alright today? No, this guy at work, right? I don't know why people do things like that. How could he speak to me like that? Folks, that event has passed. It's gone. And even the person who said it can't remember it anymore. But you, who heard it, who felt like it was a threat, it was an attack upon you, can now not get out of that because you live in the past. Whenever you are living in the past or you are living in the future, you bid farewell to Nibbana, because Nibbana only happens in the present. Nibbana only exists in the present. If in your mind you wander into the past, or you fly away into the future, believe you me, you will have to say goodbye to Nibbana, because Nibbana does not exist neither in the past nor does it exist in the future. It is in the present moment where you will find Nibbana. I'm not talking about when you're planning for things in the future. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when you're actually living in the future. When you're strangled by the future. When you're trapped in the past. When you become emotional about the future and the past. In these moments, you're actually there. Although you're physically here, mentally you're there. Don't you experience these things? How although you're here, you're mentally there? Sometimes in the past, sometimes in the future. I mean, if that weren't possible, people wouldn't plan half the things they do. Just think about it. When someone plans for a life together with somebody else, let's just say they meet someone they think is special, and now they decide, I want to live with this person for the rest of my life. Now, in their minds, right, after a few occasions of meeting each other, right, they've already started making plans about their weddings, and started making plans about how they're going to live together, and started making plans about how they're going to have children together, and then grow old together. Have you not heard these things? You know, people create these fantasy worlds in which they like to live. Have you not seen people daydreaming? They just look up into the sky and they say smiling. And then talking to themselves even. See, how can an emotion that is supposed to come in the future be happening right now? How is that possible? Now, sometimes parents, if you've seen your children daydreaming, you know they're up to no good sometimes. You can start to wonder, right, Pata, are you in a relationship? When they're so cheery, always so happy, with no obvious reason to be happy about, you can probably guess, right? They've probably found someone. These are the telltale signs. So then they're extremely happy, although they're not in the presence of the person that they like. Why is that? Although physically they're not present, mentally they're with them. Meaning, they're now living in the future. And then if you tell your child, tomorrow you're not going to class, they start to suffer from today itself. Why? Because they are now void of the future, a bliss, a happiness that can come in the future. They have just been informed that that is forbidden for them. See, once again, they start living in the future. Because the present chitta has no reason to worry about this. Because it's the future chitta that's going to experience that. But the present chitta lives in the future. It creates the future and lives in that future, and therefore the present chitta suffers. All of this is because of Sakkaya Ditti. All of this. In fact, I could put it very simply in this way. All of your sufferings, all of it, is all rooted in Sakkaya Ditti. Sakkaya Ditti is your inability to view the world for what it really is. Sakkaya Ditti is this entity-based thinking. Self is just one of those entities. Although the English translation of Sakkaya Ditti you will find in books is self-view, it goes beyond that. Self is only one of those entities. Self is the entity that you think you are and you think I am. You say Swami Mahansa is a self, but not myself, he is his self. She is herself. I am myself and you are yourselves. We are all selves. These are just one of the entities. What about this? This is also an entity. This is also a self. What self? Itself. See? Self-view. Don't we have a self behind every word? Behind every pronoun, you put a self in there. I am myself. We are ourselves. He is his self or himself. She is herself. They are themselves. You are yourselves. And it is itself. Self-view. I want you to understand exactly what this self actually means. The word self. This one. The word self is one extension of an entity-based thinking. What there is really are entities. They don't really exist. But entities, these entities are what this thinking is rooted in. Our minds, they wish to perceive the world as entities. Units, single things. A very simple example, I've mentioned this to you before, but again a few new faces in the room, so I'll say it again. When I take this cap off, whose cap have I taken off? You have an answer to that, right? Whose cap? This cap belongs to this pen. So much so that if I were to do this, if I did that, I've just swapped the caps. You feel unsettled. There's some sense of something's not right. There'll be some among you, if you've particular OCD or something, if I left the two of these pens like this, that's it. You will not be able to listen to the rest of the sermon. Because all you can think about is this. So coming back to the point, no, Swami Nasa, can you put the clips back on correctly, please? You don't know why it's happening, but it's happening. And that is because you have a sense of belonging. This cap is supposed to go on this pen, and this cap is supposed to go on this pen. Says who? Says who? When these caps were manufactured at the factory, do you think this cap was manufactured specifically for this pen? Do you think so? No. How come they have spare parts? You can buy spare parts for things, right? So if spare parts is a possibility, then those parts were not manufactured specifically for any particular object. They're just parts. Anywhere it fits, it can be used. What can you say about your kidney? Your kidney. What do you have to say about your kidney? Whose kidney is it? If it's your kidney, then that kidney cannot work in any other body. Can't it? Of course it can. A kidney can work in anybody because a kidney does what a kidney does. It's not anybody's kidney. But our self-based thinking, our entity-based thinking makes us believe, no, that kidney is my kidney. Because what it does is, what this self-based thinking does is, ladies and gentlemen, it takes what is actually there, what we call the aggregates. This is what the kaya is. Kaya is an aggregation. You've heard the word kaya, right? Kaya is an aggregation. It's a body. A collection of things is called a kaya. But when a collection of things are considered to be whole, are considered to be or seen as something that belongs to one unit, where is that one unit? Nobody knows. Nobody knows where that one unit is. Because it's not something that can be seen with the physical eye. Take this table, for instance, another example. This table is comprised of a top and four legs. It might have a few drawers, but let's forget that for a second. There's a top and four legs. Yeah? What does this top belong to? The table. What does the leg belong to? The table. Let's take the legs away and the top away. Now where's the table? Where's the table now? So now there is no longer a table. Okay, so I take another leg. I'll take one of the legs again. So what does this leg belong to? Now you can't say the table. Why not? Where's the table? So does it not belong to the table? So at which point does the top and the four legs become the table? At what point? Once you nail them all in, is that the point it becomes a table? No, those are just nails. That's just wood. Those are just legs. See, when these things come together, what your mind does is it wraps it all up into one neat package. This is Sakkaya Ditti. You wrap it all up in one package. Ultimately, you're just matter and energy. But you wrap yourself up together. You're just a mind and a body. You rub these two things together and you call it myself, me. That is the wrapper that goes on around it. There is no such wrapper in reality. It's only a fragment of your imagination. It's an illusion. You cast this onto what really exists outside. Because really what's out there are Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankar and Vijnana. These are the five aggregates. These are the five aggregates that the Buddha described. He said that is all there exists. But here's what we do. We take the five aggregates together, we put a wrapper around it, and then we say, it is not just the five aggregates, these are me. This is me. That is Sakkaya Ditti. And that's the same way you do it to this as well. There's a cap, there's a barrel, there's a nib, there's some ink in here, there's a lid here. These are merely parts. This cap is not this pen's cap. You're thinking Swaminathan has gone nuts. That is because in your mind, this pen is well and truly this pen's cap. See, this is why, like I said, if you take the cap out of this pen and put it on another pen, you feel that something's not right. I ask you, what other explanation do you have for that feeling? How do you explain that feeling? The feeling that it's not right? Now apply the same concept to yourselves. You have a body. Whose body is that? Whose body is your body? Funny question, but bear with me. Whose body is your body? It's your body, right? Isn't that why if someone else touches you, it matters to you who it is that has touched you? Does it not? Take the person sat next to you. No, don't touch them. The person sat next to you, for some of you, it would be perfectly fine if they touched you. For some of you, it wouldn't be. Here's why. I'll explain to you why that is. It is all because of Sakkaya Ditti. This is to help you get a grasp on the problem that you're in right now, ladies and gentlemen. To show you what a big, deep hole you've dug for yourselves. And therefore you suffer. That's all that happens in the end. You suffer. The person sat next to you is not really a person. That is also just matter. And a mind. Mind and matter. But what there is, more than just matter alone, what you have done is you've packaged it into an individual. So sat next to you, you feel is an individual. But what's actually there? There's skin. There's muscle. Other kinds of tissue. There's bone. There's blood. Yeah. There's veins. There's nerves. There's all that stuff. In fact, could we not separate the parts of that body into several different containers, and we can put the muscles into one, we can put the bones into one, we can put the flesh into one, that's the muscles, we can put the tissues, you know, maybe the skin into one, we can put the blood into one container. And could we not do the same thing with the next person? Just keep splitting them up into their components and then keep filling the various containers that their respective parts would go into. Could we not do that? Isn't that what happens to you when you're dead anyway? What does nature do with your bodies once you're dead? What does nature do? It decomposes you to the very elements that it gave you when it composed you. Ultimately, you are just the elements from the periodic table. Aren't you? So show me some elements from the periodic table then. Aren't you just a bunch of carbons and hydrogens and nitrogens and oxygens? So what makes you think that the person sat next to you is your wife? Aren't they just carbons and hydrogens and oxygens and nitrogens? Why do you think that the person sat on the other side is a stranger? Aren't they again carbons and hydrogens and oxygens and nitrogens? Aren't they? They are. But here's what you do. Because of Sakkaya Ditti, you have a view that sat next to you is a self. Meaning, it's an entity. Meaning, you compose all those components. You take all those components together, put a wrap around it, and then you say, that is a stranger. This is someone I know. And in the world of someone's I know, there are lots of people. There's my husband, there's my wife, there's my mother, there's my father, there's my son, there's my daughter, there's my elder son and my younger daughter. There's my uncle, there's my aunt, there's my grandmother, there's my grandfather, my great-great-grandmother. These are all the other segregations in this big box of separations. And then on the other side you have people I don't know. Ultimately, aren't they all just matter? If you need a kidney transplant, right, must it come from someone you know? Or can it come from someone who's got a kidney that is compatible? So when they look for compatibility, what are they looking for? Your relationship to them. Think, these are the answers to the riddles of life. When they check for compatibility, what do they look for? Whether it's your husband or your wife? How much you love them? Let's say there's someone who has got perfect compatibility, but you absolutely hate the bugger. And he hates you in return. Could they not donate their kidney to you? Wouldn't it work? Wouldn't it? It would. So where's the hate then? Where's the hate? Where's the kidney that came from the person that you hate? It's all in your perception. Sakkaya Ditti. Sakkaya Ditti is but nothing but putting a wrapper around Nama and Rupa. Nama and Rupa are all there is. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vinyan is another way of categorizing Nama and Rupa. Rupa is Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vinyana are Nama. So you have Nama and Rupa. In English they'll call it name and form. Whatever it is, these are the aggregates that actually exist in the world out there, ladies and gentlemen. You are all a bunch of aggregates, that's all. That's all. But you have this view inside your mind. It's a view. It's a view, like today is Sunday. What is that? Today is Sunday, what is that? Is that a fact? Is that a fact? It's a view. Could we not change that? If we all came to an agreement universally, could we not change Sunday to a Monday? Couldn't we? We could. Of course we could. So is Sunday Sunday then? Is that an absolute truth? Is it? It's not. It's just a convention. But Sunday feels somehow like Sunday, doesn't it? Don't you feel like today is there's something special about Sunday? Isn't there a Sunday feeling? Like there's a Friday feeling? That is because of your Sakkaya Ditti. In the grand scheme of things, all there are moments. What we have done as human beings is we've split them up into moments that form a year. 365 days. We've done that. This is all in the perceptions. Because there is no such thing called a year. Now you'll tell me, what about the time it takes for the earth to rotate around the sun? So who decided that was a year? Who decided that was a year? Why was that the metric for a year? Why do we celebrate the 1st of January? Tell me if you have a reasonable answer. I'm beginning to make you question your very existence now. You'll either go home and you'll think that the people at home are crazy, or they'll think you are crazy. Either way, take the Dhamma and let it heal you. Why do we celebrate the 1st of January? Here's a question for you to answer. Why? Why is that the new year? I mean, you have the earth, you have the sun, and there's an orbit around it. There's the earth. Right? So when it does one full cycle, we say that's the beginning of the new year. Why don't we consider this to be the beginning of the new year? Why can't it be the 3rd of March? Why? And besides, why is that March? Why is this March? Why? Why does a month have 30 days? Why is it just one cycle around the sun 1 year? Why can't it be two? Why can't it be 1 3/4? These are all conventions. These are merely conventions. But then there's nothing wrong with conventions, because we need conventions to live a convenient life. That's what conventions are for. We have the ladies and we have the gents. That's a convention that we must adhere to religiously. Don't forget that convention, so don't walk into the ladies if you are a gent, and don't walk into the gents if you are a lady. We don't do that. These are conventions. Conventions we adhere to because it makes life convenient. That's why they're called conventions. My point is, if we go beyond and think that conventions are absolutisms, they're absolutes, now we have a big problem. And that's what we have done. The person sat next to you, by convention, is a friend, family, or stranger. One of these three things, right? Or they could also be a colleague. The person sat next to you is either friend, family, colleague, or stranger. Absolute or convention? Pure convention. However, when you look at them, you feel that there is in fact an actual entity, an individual, a person who is family. You feel a special bond to them. You feel a special attraction towards them. This is because of Sakkaya Ditti. Sakkaya Ditti is your view. Once again, it's a view. That's why it's called a ditti. A ditti is a view. A view is something that you bear in your mind as true. That's a ditti. There are two kinds of dittis mainly. There is mitya ditti and there is samma ditti. Sakkaya Ditti is a type of mitya ditti. So ditti are broadly two categories, samma ditti and mitya ditti. Sakkaya Ditti is one of the mitya dittis. Mitya means it is wrong. You become a stream enterer at the point you realize that until this point in life, you were in Sakkaya Ditti. Because Sakkaya Ditti is a fetter. A fetter is a sanyojana. In Pali it's called a sanyojana. A fetter is something that binds you, it's like a rope. It ties you to samsara. Sakkaya Ditti is a fetter. It is your view that in this world exists entities. I'm asking you to step out of that view, because that view never did you any good. All it did you was harm and evil. Never did you any good. The reason that you look at your children or you think of your children and you suffer is because of Sakkaya Ditti. The eradication of Sakkaya Ditti has nothing to do with you fulfilling your duties and responsibilities. Nothing to do with that. It doesn't get in the way. Because fulfilling duties and responsibilities are things you have to do for your conventional children. Let me say that again. Fulfilling duties and responsibilities are something that you have to do towards your conventional children. Because who is your child is a convention. If your child is an absolute, then any stranger should be able to look at your child and go, that's your child. Because your childness is not in the child. You'll tell me, well, what about DNA, Swami Nuhansa? That's not what I'm talking about. DNA is a matter of matter. That's physical. I'm not talking about the physical stuff. I'm talking about how you perceive them. DNA does not explain your love for them, does it? DNA does not explain why when they cry, you cry. Is that in your DNA? Is it? When they cry, you cry. When they're in grievance, you're in grievance. When they die, you cry. How is that? Is that in the DNA? What if you got, your child got swapped with someone else's child at the hospital? Once in a while, this kind of thing happens. Now you walk home with a child that is not yours, biologically. Now that child suffers. Don't you suffer? Is it biological? Is it to do with DNA then? It's not. Because in your mind, that convention has become an absolute. So therefore, when that child suffers, you also suffer. Because it's not in the child. It's not in the DNA. But if that is who you are supposed to consider your child, then you have duties and you have responsibilities. So you've got to give them a good education. You've got to feed them. You've got to wash them. You've got to clean them. You've got to give them shelter. All of these things you've got to do. Today I'm a father. Not biologically. But I'm a father to about 150 children who I have at the monastery. The Sangha, all of us at the monastery, we look after those children. You may be the biological parents of those children. In the audience there are some. The biological mothers and the biological fathers. But what you realized was this. You realized that giving the children just an education alone is not going to help them solve the problems of life. So therefore what you wanted us to give them was the Dhamma. And to give them a good upbringing in the Dhamma. To root themselves in the Dhamma. To give them a strong foundation. So that they would not suffer like you do today. Your parents wanted you to be happy, right? If you still have them with you, they still want you to be happy. If you've lost them, they wanted you to be happy. But they couldn't give you the method to be happy. They showed you how to make money. They showed you how to get rich. They showed you how to become wealthy, how to become educated, how to become someone in society. They showed you how to earn respect. They showed you how to give respect. They showed you how to achieve status. And so, you did. But all of that was supposed to be a means to another end. And that was, they wanted you to be happy. Unfortunately, you've become anything but. Because none of those paths that they paved for you were the paths to happiness. Money doesn't bring you happiness. Beauty doesn't bring you happiness. You know, I was just thinking about this the other day, ladies and gentlemen. If you're a parent, or if you are a child, it is considered very fortunate, is it not, to have a child who is very attractive, good looking, especially if it's a girl. Right? Parents are generally very happy, very pleased to have a daughter who's very pretty, very attractive. But from that day forward, don't they live in fear? Fathers in the house, mothers. It's one thing to have a beautiful daughter, but it's another thing to live with that. Every time your daughter steps out to go to school, to go to her classes, to go to work, what are you constantly in? Fear. So, is it a blessing Or is it a curse? But you feel proud as a father, don't you? When your children are attractive, very good looking. You know, mothers, when they have their babies, you know, they hold, she's so fair. She's so charming. Look at her. She's a picture of beauty. Can you leave her with her uncle? I know mothers and fathers in the room can give me evidence to this. You are living and breathing testimonies of this. So to have a pretty child, is that a blessing or a curse? You tell me. Actually, you don't even need to tell me. You think about it. It is said to be born beautiful is a merit. Right? We've heard in the stories, people used to do lots of meritorious deeds. I'm asking you to step outside of that foolish thinking. There may be those who make offerings, maybe offer some flowers, right, and make a resolve, may I be born as beautiful as these flowers. Before you do that, just remember these words. If you are born beautiful in this society, you will have to constantly live under threat. You might be abused. Because if you're ugly, people will probably leave you alone. Let's talk facts. Yeah? Cut out the bull. Let's talk facts. If you're ugly, people will probably leave you alone. But if you're pretty, try getting on a bus. Try walking down the street. Try going somewhere at night, alone. But don't parents make it a big deal to help that they want their children to look attractive and pretty and beautiful and all that? But then from that point on, they have to live in constant fear. So is it? I ask you again. It is merit. I agree. I admit it is out of merit one is born beautiful. Ultimately, there is nothing that is beautiful, ladies and gentlemen. It's only a convention. You know, if we live in a society where it is considered beautiful to have your nose right in the dead center of your face, then to be born like that is beautiful. But what if convention says that your nose has to be up here? Then that is what beauty is. Remember the other day we discussed how Aishwarya Rai was considered by all to be a very beautiful woman? It's because she fit the bill. That's why. She ticked many of the conventional boxes. Because beauty is not an absolute concept. It's a conventional concept. It's all in the mind. It's what you perceive to be beautiful. But the thing is, when you do meritorious deeds, and if you make a resolve, by the power of these merits, may I be born beautiful. May I be born attractive. Do remember, you're asking for trouble. You're asking for trouble. Your parents will have to keep you on a lock and key. You will not be able to step outside your four walls. People will always try to hack your computer, try to watch you on the webcam. Because they'll want you. They'll want the sight of you. They'll want the sound of you. They'll want the smell of you. They'll want the taste of you. And they'll want the touch of you. And when they want something, they won't stop until they can get it. If you don't believe me, go ask your uncle. Sakkai Ditti. Because what those people fail to see is that this is just carbons, hydrogens, oxygens and nitrogens. These are just pigments. This is just skin. This is just matter. This is just energy taking a particular configuration. They think this is a person. This is what is called the Satta Sanya. To see that something or someone is a sentient being. It's a perception. It's ignorance. It's based and rooted in ignorance. But because of that, people then do what we call vichikiccha. Weird, distorted, warped actions, thoughts, and speech. These are actions that individuals take to achieve that which is simply an illusion of the mind. You see, because if it's an illusion, you have to do it on your own, mustn't you? A magic trick must be performed by the magician. It doesn't happen in nature. Illusions don't happen in nature. They have to be created by yourself. See, who can dream on your behalf? Can anyone dream on your behalf? Can you see someone else's dreams? If you wanted to have a dream, can someone else do that on your behalf? Can they? No. Who can do that? Only you can do that. Why is that? Because what is a dream? It's virtually an illusion, isn't it? A dream is virtually an illusion. Let's say in your dreams you want to be a fairy and you want to fly around. The only place you can achieve that is in your dreams. Nowhere else can you do that. That's why I said dream on. You can't achieve that in the real world. So, if you want to experience being a fairy, you've got to sleep and then you've got to have a dream. No one else can do it on your behalf because they're virtually illusions. They defy physics, the laws of physics. They defy the laws of reality. Nothing in the real world applies to those things. That's why you can fly in your dreams. You can go underwater for days on. You can be a mermaid in your dreams. Because those are just dreams. In the same way, when you want to see an entity, you've got to dream. You've got to create that illusion all by yourself. And that activity, that process by which you create this illusion, is vichikiccha. That process is a mental process. I'm only touching the surface today. Some of this is quite heavy, I understand. You don't need to really understand this in any detail, because as long as you understand the Dhamma, the fetters of Sakkayaditti Vichikiccha and Silabbatha Paramasa will be removed from you when it happens. Whenever it happens, it will happen. You don't need to understand Vichikiccha is Vichikiccha and Silabbatha Paramasa is Silabbatha Paramasa and Dakkayaditti is Sakkayaditti. You don't need to understand them as such, but it helps to understand particularly what Sakkayaditti is, because that is the view out of which you need to get out. Once you get out of Sakkayaditti, Vichikiccha stops happening within you. All unmeritorious deeds are a category of Vichikiccha. All unmeritorious deeds. Now try and think about why it is so. Let's take theft. One example, theft. When you steal, you have to steal something, and that something must belong to what? Someone. Yeah? So you have to steal an itself, and it has to belong to oneself. Themselves, their selves, his self or herself. Now do you see how theft is based in Sakkayaditti? Did you get it? Because if there is no it, and there is no he, she or they from whom I take it, how can they be theft? The concept of theft is rooted in Sakkayaditti. Because in my hand, what I have is not really a pen. This is just a matter of matter. This is just matter. This is just energy. Configured in a certain way. It has taken a certain structure. Excuse me. This is just an arrangement of matter and energy. We refer to this as a pen because what it can do. Because of what it can do, we call it a pen. Because of what this can do, we call it a fan. Once again, this is just matter and energy. This is also matter and energy. Because of what you can do, we call you humans. You can do something different to what this can do. That's why we don't call you a pen. And that's why we don't call this a human. Based on what something can do, thanks to the way that matter and energy have combined to form a certain particular structure, we give it a name. That's why, take a simple example, ladies and gentlemen, bricks, mortar, together, we call it what? A house. Once you start laying, you lay your bricks, right? You put the mortar and you build a house. But the individual bricks, you don't call them houses, do you? But when you build a house, is it not the same stuff? Just a different arrangement? That's my point. There is no more a house than there is an arrangement of the blocks that are used to build it. The house is merely an arrangement of matter. The same matter, if you disperse it, you no longer call it a house. So what are you then? You think you're a man. You think you're a woman. How are you so different? Don't you all eat from the same pot at home? Aren't you all serve the same food at home? You eat the same food, but then that food goes into a different structure. It's a different arrangement. Therefore, one becomes man, the other becomes woman. So when there is no it self, and this it self does not belong to himself, how can there be theft? Tell me how you can steal if this is not here and it doesn't belong to anybody. What is the premise? Now you see, theft is a concept that disintegrates when the concept of sakkayaditti goes away. You cannot steal. Not you are forbidden from stealing. You cannot steal. The concept of stealing can no longer survive in your mind when the concept of sakkayaditti goes away. That's why an arahatan vahanse is called punya papa pahinasa. An arahatan vahanse cannot steal because theft does not compute in his mind. Why? Because there is nothing to steal from anyone. Because there are no ones and there are no things to steal. What about killing then? What about killing? You kill someone, right? You kill someone. You kill an animal. What is an animal? When there is merely matter and energy, but it's the wrapper that is around it, that is that we perceive in our minds out of ignorance, that we think that that is a man, a woman, an animal, and so on. Now, when we separate mind from matter, in our minds, we believe that we are actually killing the animal. That's why the Buddha says, volition is karma. You heard this. Volition is karma. Cetana ambikave kammang vadami. Cetana is not something that happens on the outside. If you separate mind and matter, let's take a human being. We separate the mind from the body. When does the doctor declare someone dead? When they say that he is no longer functioning, right? They're dead. In other words, the mind is no longer in the body. That's when we say the person's dead. So, killing then is, ladies and gentlemen, to separate the mind from the body. That is what killing is. But then why can't a Rahatan Vahanse kill? A Rahatan Vahanse cannot kill because in their mind, they don't perceive an animal. They don't perceive a being. They don't perceive an entity. They don't perceive a self. For killing to happen, there has to be a self whose mind is separated from their body. That is all to do with the perception of the person who thinks of killing. It's not something that happens in the environment out there. I've just given you two examples, one of theft and one of killing. These two things can only take place when you have Sakkaya Ditti within you. Because these are what we call, these are examples of vichikiccha. Examples of vichikiccha. Vichikiccha cannot happen where Sakkaya Ditti does not reside. So for today, I just want you to understand what Sakkaya Ditti is. That in itself is enough. I can see it's quite heavy. You didn't expect this today, did you? Because, you know, this Dhamma is very profound. It's very profound. I'm sharing it. This is why I say you have to come and ordain yourselves. This seems difficult or maybe a little bit too complicated because you don't spend enough time with the Dhamma. That's why. That's all. Most of your time is spent with what? Sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch. This is the sensual world. Most of your time is spent with the sensual world. And most of your time is spent contemplating on sentient beings. You interact with sentient beings. At the monastery, when we meet two Swaminohanses, when two monks meet each other, you know, in their mind they're thinking, mind and matter. Both of them. Therefore, we can interact with each other as mind and matter. So no one is offended if someone doesn't pat them on the back, shake hands, smile, cry when the other one's crying. No one's offended. But in your lives, if you don't show affection, what happens? They're offended. If you don't share their grief, what happens? Offended. So therefore, you have to live this drama when you're there. That's the thing. The drama that you live becomes your life. And ultimately, that becomes your reality. And that is what has happened. I know this seems so unfair. I don't know why I'm saying these things to you, honestly. I'll probably kick myself on my way out today for having said some of these things to you. Because I know it seems really unfair because I'm asking you to step into something bigger, something greater than where you are right now. That's why I say at least, you know, one day, someday, make a resolve. Make a resolve that someday I want to go into the sasana. Because once you're in the sasana, you have the environment which supports you on your path to Nibbana. I'm not undermining your efforts. Please don't think of it that way. Absolutely not. I always congratulate you and appreciate you for making the effort that you do. But I always know at the back of my mind, this is not enough. Am I wrong to feel that way? I only feel that way because I care about you. This is not enough. You need to be doing more. You need to be doing more if you want to attain Nibbana as soon as possible. You know, in this birth, let's say the next birth, what assurance do you have that in the next birth you're going to come across the Buddha's teaching again? You remember the video that we watched last week? Buddhism is distorted all over the place now. People say all sorts of things in the name of Buddhism. They do all sorts of things in the name of Buddhism. They sing, they dance in the name of Buddhism nowadays. It seems like anything goes. That's why just observing the precepts, going to the temples, offering alms, you know, all of these things are good, ladies and gentlemen, but that alone is not going to get you to Nibbana. For that, you need a practice. A pratipada is very important for that. And that practice has to come within the environment that you create for yourself. When you wanted to become a doctor, remember when you were younger, you didn't just take the classes. At home, you created the environment for that. Do you remember the picture, the poster that you put up on the wall? You had on the wall, you had a picture of a doctor, if you wanted to become one. If you wanted to become a cricketer, what did you have on the wall? A poster of a cricketer, because you wanted to always be reminded of them. You try to walk like them. You try to dress like them. You try to talk like them. You try to behave like them and act like them. You try to spend time with them, didn't you? So then if you want to become an arahant, what must you do? You tell me. Watch TV. Go to a party. Play games. Or spend as much time as you possibly can with the Rahatan Vahanses. At least the Sangha Vahanses. That's why I say, what you do, hats off to you. But it's not enough. Because here's the deal. This is the last thing I'm going to say. I know this for certain. In a few years' time, I'll be dead. Some of you will outlive me. Some of you won't. You and I, we won't meet again. That much I can tell you. Because if we do, you'll have to ask me, what the heck were you doing, Swami Nansa, with all the food that we offered you? I don't want to be in your debt again. I have been in your debt as you have been mothers to me, you have been fathers to me. I have been in your debt countless times in sansara. I have come here to repay those debts. I don't want to be left with any more debts when we depart for the last time. There's going to be a last time. You know that. It might be one day where I come and sit down here, you come here for the sermon, we do the merit transfer, we part our ways and we'll never meet again. It might be tomorrow, might be next week, might be in 3 months' time, might be in 3 years' time. But here's what I know for certain. I'm not going to be living for another 100 years. In a few years' time, I'll be 40. Even if I live until I'm 60, I've only got another 20 years to go. That's hardly anything at all. You and I, we won't meet again. This is the only chance I have to repay my debts to you and to help you overcome these problems that you have in your lives and the suffering that keeps you bound to sansara with no refuge, no resort to a moment's happiness because you constantly live in the past and you live in the future. The answer to these problems are in the Dhamma. I can see from where I am sitting, you're not doing enough. I know I sound like an old school principal right now. What I'm saying is, folks, I need you to do more. Once again, I know this might sound unreasonable, but I need you to do more. There will be other Swamin Vahanses, I'm sure, who will come and repay their debts, but they'll pay their debts and they'll be gone. Another Swamin Vahanses will come, they'll pay their debts and they'll be gone. You are the debt collectors. When are you going to go? It's like we are running the marathon. You're standing by the side and you're cheering us on. You splash us with water. You give us the drinks. You give us some energy drinks and you cheer us on. We run the marathon. And we get the cup. And we win and we celebrate. When are you going to join the marathon? Because you don't get prizes for cheering the runners on. You don't get a prize for that. You can scream at the top of your voice. They don't have a prize for the best screamer. They don't have a prize for the best cheerer. When are you going to run the marathon? To win this marathon, you have to start somewhere, someday. You have started crawling, but to win the marathon, you have to start running. Walking is also good, but to win it anytime soon, you have to start running. When are you going to do that? Are you going to tell me Swaminathan's a children Swaminathan? Job Swaminathan? Mortgage Swaminathan? The house I built Swaminathan? The land I bought Swaminathan? The car Swaminathan? What about the wife Swaminathan? I ask you, what about you? You're not doing enough. I can say that today because I know how much more I am doing today as a monk, and I have been for the last 6 years, and I still haven't become a Rahatan Mansi. Just think about it. If I have become a monk and have committed my life to the noble path for the last 6 years, and even as a lay person, I didn't have much of the duties and responsibilities as you did. I had a loving wife and she was also committed to attaining her salvation. So we were both committed to the cause. And as soon as we got to hear the Dhamma, all of the other adventures, all the other interesting things that we had back then, all of that just went away. And we just got down to sustaining ourselves. So even before I stepped into becoming a monk, into that life, I'd already become a monk in my lay life. So this spiritual journey, it has been about the last 10 years or so. I've been on it. And I still haven't become a Rahatan Mahansi. When is it going to happen for you? Why are there those in the audience who are capable of making this step? Taking this step and are still not doing it. Why? Are you waiting for the next obligation? Are you waiting for that knot to be tied around your finger? What gives? Are you waiting to make that choice once you've made which you can't turn back? Are you waiting for that choice? Because then it'll be too late. I tell you, we won't meet again. This is our last meeting. If in my next life I have to come and meet you, chase me away. You can ask me then, what were you doing as a monk? You can ask me. This is our last meeting. So this is the only time I get to speak to you. And I urge you, the Buddha's dispensation will only last another 2,500 years. If in your next birth you are born into somewhere, into the Sahara, some Arabian country somewhere, how are you ever going to come across the teaching? Fortunately, most of you were born to Buddhist parents. So therefore, you were not entirely skeptics of Buddhism. But most people who are born to other religions, they really struggle to come across and to actually just sit down and listen to a sermon. Because it is such that their teachings, their religion, forbid them from even listening to a sermon. There are some religions like that. They forbid them from listening. It's like listening to another teaching is a sin. Isn't that the perfect trap? Once you put that on, now, no escape. Because if you listen to another teaching, God will punish you. There are some religions like that. Aren't you fortunate that you were born to Buddhist parents? What guarantee do you have that next time it will be the same? This is a very rare occurrence, ladies and gentlemen. Please understand that. A very, very, very rare occurrence. To have been born human. To have been born in this land. To have been born into the Theravada Buddhism. To have been born to Buddhist parents, to have come across the teaching. Did you ever think 5 years ago you and I would have met? 3 years ago, 2 years ago, a year ago, 6 months ago. What are the chances of something like this happening? What are you waiting for? Age? To beat you down? Misfortune? A vehicle to run over you? Once you break your leg, I can't help you. You can't come into this asana after that. What are you waiting for? Parents, what are you keeping your children back for? To teach them well. For what? Teach them and become and help them become an engineer, a doctor, and then live a holy life? Or to live a life of dreadful sin and then go and die? You know how many doctors are corrupt? Next time you go to the hospital and you say your left kidney is not working, be careful, your right kidney might also be removed. Careful. I'm not saying all doctors are like that, but they are also pressure cookers. They have bills to pay. They have a status that they have to show to society. They have a reputation they have to keep. So when push comes to shove, by hook or by crook. I'm not saying doctors are bad. I'm saying ignorance and attachment is bad. And once ignorance and attachment takes over, it doesn't matter whether you're a doctor, you're an engineer, you're a lawyer, you're a scientist, you're a mother, you're a father, it doesn't matter who you are. There are nowadays, don't go where I'm telling you, there are nowadays websites on what is called the dark web where parents have no shame. Parents have no shame to engage in sexual acts with their own children. Pressure cookers have sympathy. It's not that they're terrible. That is what ignorance and attachment does. All because they can get some bitcoins out of it. So because they have bills to pay. They have bills to pay. And there are things they'd like to eat. There are places they like to go. They like to live a certain lifestyle. So for that, they need money. And no one's willing to give them a job. So, there's an easy way to make money. A mother with a 2-year-old boy. Don't watch these things. You won't be able to bear the shock. So just take it from my word. Ask that mother the day she had her child, would she have considered? She would curse me for asking the question. But today, 2 years on, the child doesn't know what the hell is going on. But the mother does everything a woman would do with a man. All you have to do is spend a few bitcoins. You can buy drugs. They'll deliver it to you. You can order specific murders. If you want a certain person dead, you just have to put an order. So don't fall out with your neighbors. Because now it's just a few bitcoins. There are sites you can go and place your order. I want that person's ear, left ear. Send me a video of you severing their ear and send me the ear in the post as well. They'll do that. No morals, but they've learned. They've had a good education. No morals. No virtues. No fear of the afterlife. No fear of God. No sense of right or wrong. This is what society has come to today. And that is where you want to keep your children. If it is so bad today, just imagine if you die and you're born again in another 50 years' time, how terrible do you think the world is going to be then? Today, if this is so bad, in 50 years' time. For those who will be dead in another 5 years, there will be some among you who will be like that. Some among you will be dead in another 10 years. Right? You're dead, you're born again. And once you come of age, it'll be another 50 years from now on. You know what society is going to be like that then? This will be a cesspit. I don't get why you still want to hang around. That's why I ask you again, those who can, why don't you? If you're not bound by a duty, by a responsibility, by an obligation, if you're not a mother who has to feed her child, if you're not a father who has to work to feed the family, then what are you waiting for? A big tsunami is coming your way, I'm telling you folks, and you and I, we are not going to meet again. I've had enough of this world. It's not a nice place to be in. I'm getting the heck out of here. If you want, you can come with me. But I can't do it for you. I'm happy to do it with you. Can't do it for you. You're not doing enough. If you think you're pretty, be careful. Someone somewhere wants you. And if they can't get you, they'll want your nose for it. Don't trust me? That is what people are like today. If I can't have her, gone. Nobody else is going to have her either. Avidya. So be careful. If you have a good-looking daughter, be careful. Lest someone might want her and you're not happy to give your daughter to him. He'll have her or he'll make sure that nobody else has her. How do you stop that from happening? Put her in a fortress. Lock her up in a cell. What do you do? You can either give her protection or you can give her freedom, not the two together. If you want to give her freedom, you're going to have to take away protection. If you want to give her protection, take away her freedom. Parents, agreed or not? What are you waiting for? Until you become the victim. There are many crazy people out there. They'll kill for a few thousand rupees. You're just waiting to become the victim. All you have to be, and the sin is to be born pretty. Well done. You're pretty. You're pretty, well done. Like squatting flies, this society will squat you to get what they want. So far, you live in a civil society, you have chosen some part of the country where you think it's safe, right? Where you think you live in a safe neighborhood. These things are all you think to yourself. So you built walls around your house, there are barbed wires, there are security cameras, you might even have a security guard to watch over every step 24/7, keep you all safe. But the moment you step outside, you're fair game. People want drugs because drugs are getting harder to find. Okay? And once something gets harder to find, it's going to get more expensive. And once it gets more expensive, they need to find the money to buy it. Who has money? You have it. Don't worry, I won't tell them. So, rich people in the house, you better watch out. Because drugs are getting harder and harder and harder to find. Meaning, they are getting more and more and more expensive. Meaning, people now need the money to buy it. Meaning, they're going to come after the people who have the money. And if you have it, good luck. Ask me what is merit today, and I'll tell you this. Not to be born pretty, not to be born rich, not to be born wealthy, just to be born human, barely, and then to be able to have the opportunity to go into the sasana. I don't have enemies, because there is nothing I want. There is nothing I have that people want. Only the Dhamma. That's all I have. I don't have a bank account to my name. I don't have property to my name. I don't have a daughter to protect. I don't have a son to protect. I don't have anything other than a teacher and the Dhamma. If you want it, it's free. You don't have to kill me for it. But things that you have, are worth killing for. Things that I have, you can't get if you kill me. You're not doing enough. I care about you people. That's why I speak like this. But how long will someone speak on your behalf? For how long? You are just a number. You are just a number. To the country, you're just a number. To your workplace, you're just a number. To your family, you're just a provider. To you, you're everything. When you are lost, the country loses one. Your workplace loses one. Your family loses a provider. To you, you lose everything. Work on your salvation while you still can. Please, on your behalf. Now I understand why the Buddha would have had so much compassion. Why even when he was so utterly ill, he would still go around, land to land, walking on foot, preaching the Dhamma. Because he knew, after I am gone, this world will not have a Buddha again for many, many, many eons. People like me will come and go, but Buddhas don't come so often. Therefore, he was not willing to go until at least he had established a sasana that would live for another 5,000 years. Just imagine the duty that he must have felt, the responsibility. It goes to prove to you, you don't need attachment to have responsibility. He had no attachment, but he fulfilled his responsibility. 2 hours of sleep is all he got. Sometimes I feel ashamed that I have to sleep at least 4 to 6 hours. On many occasions the doctor tells me, I don't sleep enough. This is the advice a lot of our monks get when we get consulted by doctors. You don't sleep enough. But how can I sleep? Knowing that you're not doing enough. Because only these words can make an influence on you. Only these words can get you to change the way you think. I can show you some videos. I can say a few things. Other than that, who's helping you? So how can I sleep? Knowing that my duty is here with you. So, take it seriously and do what you have to do to save yourselves, especially to those in the audience who are not yet bound by duty, responsibility and obligation. I speak to those who have not yet become husbands, who have not yet become wives, who have not yet become mothers, who have not yet become fathers, who yet have youth on their side, because you need the support of all that to enter the sasana and to walk it conveniently, comfortably. So if there are those in the audience who are yet to tie themselves down with such duties and responsibilities, what are you waiting for? Are you waiting for the day where you become like the rest of the audience and then when asked, they have an answer to give? I am a mother, Swami Nuhansa. I am a father. I am married, Swami Nuhansa. I am too old, Swami Nuhansa. That's why I am not coming to the sasana. I don't particularly want you in the sasana. The sasana is fine without you, it's fine. I'm asking you to give yourself the sasana. When I talk to parents, I tell them, don't think that you're giving your son or your daughter to the sasana. Think that you're giving the sasana to your daughter or your son. This is the gift. You don't want your children to suffer. Giving an education is not the answer. You don't want your children to suffer. Giving them all the money in the world is not the answer. Handing over your inheritance to them is not the answer. They will still suffer. Suffering is caused by attachment. The only way to rid from suffering is to rid attachment. Money doesn't do that. The Dhamma does that. I'll leave you with that. Finally, I have an invitation to make. Over the past few months, we've been building a pagoda at the monastery. You might have seen the last time you came, it was still work in progress. But now it is almost done. And on the 23rd, there will be a ceremony to open the pagoda. And then from the 23rd on till the 30th, what we have planned on doing is taking in groups of people, underrepresented groups of society, people who don't have many opportunities to earn merits, such as patients in the cancer hospital, such as members of the armed forces who served our nation, but today they are disabled. We need to take care of them for what they have done for us. We need to help them, give them a ticket to Nibbana also, because it is thanks to them, you and I can today sit down here comfortably, practice the Dhamma. Because in saving the nation, they earned merits, but in killing lives, taking lives, they earned demerits. Like I said, it doesn't matter why you kill. Even if you kill in the name of your country or your king, you are still committing unmeritorious deeds, and for that you have to suffer. It is the doer who always has to suffer. So if they have killed on our behalf, it is our duty to help them. Once they become a sotapanna, that's it, the four greats. So the four great helps are close to them. That is all we want to help them achieve. So likewise, we have split up the 7 days from the 23rd on to receive various groups of people. So there'll be sometimes disabled children, sometimes children with Down syndrome. Sometimes they don't have the capacity to understand the Dhamma, but they can still come and offer some alms, maybe offer an atavirikara and earn some merits out of it. They may not be able to absorb the full gravity of what they're doing, but every little helps. So likewise, we have split the program up and we have managed to separate a day for the Dharmishtha Rajagiriyans as well. So your day is the 24th which is the Sunday just after the 23rd. So that being a Sunday, the sermon will be held at the monastery, just for that Sunday. So on that 24th Sunday, you will not be arriving at the school. Please make your way to the monastery. We would like to have you there by 6 a.m. so that we can precept you and start the sermon at just after 7. You will have your morning breakfast there as well. That will also be offered. And then from 7 on, you will have the sermon, after which we will have a small procession, perahara. And you will be given the opportunity to take part and get involved in the opening of the pagoda. So what we're going to do is, the pagoda will be opened on the 23rd, but what we are going to do is deposit something very special in the dargaba. Here's what we want you to do. You can find in any herbal medicine stores copper leaves, tambapat. If you go and ask for them, you can find them very easily. So each and every one of you who would like to get involved, and if there's for any reason you're not able to come along on that Sunday, you can bring it and hand it over to us the previous week. So next week, if you hand it over, we can take it and deposit that on your behalf. So take a piece of copper leaf, and on there, this is what we have asked everyone at the monastery to do, so myself included, all of the monks, anagarikas, anagarikas, and all of the devotees, we are all doing this. Write on that piece of copper leaf how you have benefited from the Buddha Sasana in a few lines. So I think at the shop, you can, when you buy them, it will be 2 inches wide and about 10 inches long. This is, they come in a standard size. So write down how you have benefited from the Buddha Sasana on that copper leaf. Fold it up and bring it in. You can either bring it in and hand it in to us here, or you can do it at the monastery if you are able to come on the 24th Sunday. And so whatever you bring, we will be able to deposit in the Dhatugaba. So that will be the offering that you will be making. It is customarily, people offer many valuable things like gold and all sorts of other jewelry and so on. That is not necessary. So we don't need that, because we are very practical in what we do. If there is something of value, what we'd rather do is convert that to a bag of rice, so that we can feed people, or build a roof so that people can come and actually practice the Dhamma, rather than stacking them in chambers where it is of no use to anybody. So we like to be very practical in the way we approach things, and the same applies here. So if you would like to make an offering, then rather than put it into the Dhatugaba, that is up to you how you would like to do that. But each and every one of you can take part in this meritorious deed by doing what I just asked you to do earlier. So write it on a piece of copper leaf, roll it up and bring it in, and you can deposit it yourself when you come to the monastery. So there will be the sermon there as well, and after we have the procession, you'll be able to offer alms, because that will be a Dakshinayo event on the day as well. You've been to one Dakshinayo before, so this will also be a Dakshinayo event. So 100 monks will be prepared to accept alms on the day. And we're also planning on doing something quite special on that day. So this Dakshinayo event is going to be mainly sponsored by some of our devotees in Japan. And our plan is to actually compare the event in Japanese as a tribute for them. Don't worry, it will be done in English and in Sinhala as well. But we plan to compare the event also in Japanese so that they are impressed, because we are doing something to help them. And actually, we are learning Japanese at the monastery so that we can spread the Dhamma in Japanese. And we're learning Italian so that we can spread the Dhamma in Italian. We're learning Spanish so that we can spread the Dhamma in Spanish. In a total of 13 languages we learn at the monastery right now. And we've already started preaching in Hindi. You may have seen some sermons online. We're going to be starting in Tamil very soon. In German very soon. Just around the corner. And several other languages to come soon enough. Because people need to hear the truth, that's all. So we are doing that for the first time, actually comparing an event in a foreign language. But you will be able to make sense of all that because it's going to be done in Sinhalese and English as well. I just thought it'd be nice to know. So 24th Sunday, the event will be held at the monastery. This sermon will also be held there, and you're all welcome. Like last time, you don't need to register anywhere to let us know whether you're coming or not. It's free for all. You can come along, you can come with your family, you can bring your friends along, you can bring your colleagues, whoever you like. You can bring the pet dog if you want. We'll have to leave him outside. Anyone and everyone who can understand the Dhamma and who can earn some merits out of a meritorious deed like this, you're all welcome. It is your monastery and we want you to feel part of it. This is why you will, by your own hand, make in that deposit. And that chaitya, that pagoda, will last for another 600 years. Maybe 1,000 years. One day, someone will come and, when they come along, people will come and, they'll be looking for what was here, what was there, when you and I will not be there any longer. Then they might come and break into the pagoda to find out what was there 600 years ago. And then they will find these little copper leaves written by you, sharing with the world how you have benefited from the Buddha Sasana. So then people will one day think, there have been people just like themselves 600 years ago who were diligent about their practice and who wanted their salvation. We will also be depositing some of our sermons that we have done. So it will be like a time capsule. Some of our sermons in the Dagaba, so that, when whatever that time comes, maybe YouTube will not be there then, who knows. But they'll be able to access the Dhamma that we have been delivering to the world, so that someone can benefit out of it. So the event is on the 24th, and you're all welcome. Alright, let's transfer the merits and bring today's sermon to a close. Okay, so first and foremost then, let us all take a moment to remind ourselves how extremely fortunate we are to be in the presence of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief priests of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to our teacher Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika, Zanagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by delivering the sermons, transliterating these sermons, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide for the construction of the monastery and provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, those who have gone the extra mile on our behalf and have left no stone unturned on our behalf, for all who have helped us, supported us, and assisted us. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to them. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the Nimas gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our loved ones who have passed away in our names, to our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts that we do and are able to practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to those who made great sacrifices on our behalf, members of the armed forces as well as members of the police force. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, as well as the recent pandemics, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends and acquaintances to us, those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape and form possible and available to them. Therefore, out of compassion and gratitude towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahatyanin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatva, dvesha ginnen midatva, moha ginnen midatva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva, mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Raga gini niveva, dvesha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivan sapa labeva, nivan sapa labeva, nivan sapa labeva. Tunruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen siyalu loka siyalu sattayoma nibbana parama sukhen sukhita taravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.